The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. My name is Jason Freeman, and I'm pleased to be here to welcome Michael Kazin to our virtual stage. Before I do that, I'd just like to mention that tonight's talk is the Jill and Sheldon Bonovitz Endowed Lecture. So we here in Author Events and at the library would like to thank them for their very generous support. Michael Kazin's many critically acclaimed books include War Against War, The American Fight for Peace, 1914 to 1918, selected as an editor's choice by the New York Times Book Review, American Dreamers, How the Left Changed a Nation, chosen as best book of 2011 by the New Republic, Newsweek, and The Progressive, A Godly Hero, The Life of William Jennings Bryan, and The Populist Persuasion. A history professor at Georgetown University, he is the editor emeritus of Dissent Magazine, a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and editor of the Princeton Encyclopedia of American Political History. He joins us tonight with What It Took to Win, A History of the Democratic Party. It's a sweeping history of the Democratic Party and its imperfect but recently reinvigorated journey towards making genuine progress for all Americans. A review in last week's Los Angeles Times reads, in his sweeping account, Kazin takes a big step back to see a way forward, searching for clues to Democrats' successes and failures over the last 200 years. It is an illuminating shift of perspective for Democrats now transfixed by internal struggles and dispirited by their grim prospects in this year's midterm elections. Tonight, Mr. Kazin will be in conversation with Tamela Edwards, anchor of 6ABC Action News Morning Edition. I'd also just note she's a great supporter of the Free Library and a great friend to the Author Events Office and one of our favorite journalists and interviewers. Michael, Tam, thank you so much for being here, and the screen is all yours.
All right, thank you, Jason, and good evening, Michael. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for doing this.
And, you know, I wanted you quote Jill Lepore in the opening pages of the book, where she says, to write history is to make an argument by telling a story. And so I thought I'd let you do a place setter and explain to people watching, what was the story you wanted to tell? You've written a lot of books on a lot of different topics. What brought you to this, and what did you want to tell?
That's the question. Great question. First of all, thanks for doing this, and thanks to the Free Library. I'm sorry I can't be there in person, but hope these times of not being in person and talking about ideas and books will soon be passing. So why did I write this book? I wrote the book because I've, for most of my life, been a Democrat with a capital D, and I hope a Democrat with a small d as well, believed in democracy. And I want to understand, you know, right after Donald Trump was elected is when I really started to work on this book, about 5-6 years ago now, why the Democrats had lost that election, but more widely, why Democrats have done well when they've done well, when they haven't, why they've failed to win elections, which I hope they would win, and also how the institution of this first mass political party in the history of the world, actually, not just in the U.S., but the world, has evolved over time from being a party that defended slavery, to being the party that promoted civil rights bill and the Voting Rights Act, from the party that wanted government to be small and powerless for the most part, to the party that wants to have big government that will help people. So it was really sort of both personal and scholarly and political, obviously. Every other book I've written has been prompted by a question that I want to answer. And I think those are the best kind of questions. And the argument, very briefly, of the book, going off the Jill Lepore's quote, which I love, I always give that quote to my students. I said, this is, they say, what's history? I said, this is what history is. You know, you got to tell a good story, but you have to have a point. You have to have an argument. And the argument, very briefly, is that Democrats have done best when they can appeal to the great majority of the population, who are working people by different definitions. And they appeal to them with an economic program, an economic vision that I call moral capitalism. I'm not a term I invented. I got it from a friend of mine who's also a very good historian, Elizabeth Cohen. And that they can unite different parts of the coalition around a vision of regulating capitalism, of making capitalism helpful to the ordinary working person, using government to do that. And that's when Democrats have done best. When they haven't done so well, it's when they get their coalition divides on different issues. And of course, other things happen as well to make it very difficult. But that, I think, is a theme that runs throughout the history of the Democratic Party, from Andrew Jackson, who is not someone I'd want to emulate today, to Joe Biden. Joe Biden's trying, I think, with the Build Back Better program, with some of his other programs, he's passed, some he's not been able to pass, to realize a reformed, more moral capitalism. And so that's the basic argument of the book.
As I was reading it, I thought, you know, Bill Clinton really did encapsulate it right on a postcard. It's the economy, stupid. And history showed us over and over again that this seemed to be true. And also what I thought was interesting about the book is that we think that we live in these times, and this is the first time we've seen this, these divisions, these arguments over race, this argument over class, this argument over to be progressive or not. But the book sort of showed, it's almost a historical echo over and over and over and over again, that we've been here before. And sometimes it's been a lot worse.
Oh, yeah. Well, we had a civil war. And why do we have a civil war? Well, obviously, because of slavery. And the South wanted to expand slavery. And most people in the North, whether they were racist or not wanting to expand slavery. But what wouldn't have happened if the Democratic Party hadn't split? 1860, as maybe people out there know, if you remember your high school history, the Democrats had two different candidates, a Southern Democratic candidate named Breckinridge from Kentucky, who was actually the vice president at the time, and a Northern Democratic candidate, Stephen Douglas. And the party split, and Abraham Lincoln was able to get elected because the majority party at the time, which were the Democrats, split in two. And if they stayed together, they probably would have elected one of their candidates. And we never would have had Lincoln, and the South might not have seceded. Unfortunately, slavery also would not have been abolished anytime soon.
And another thing, you know, we talk about race in these modern times and the scourge that it has been in the Democratic Party. And you talk about the big flip that goes on under FDR, going from being the last place Black voters would go to being the party of Black voters. But over and over again, the question is raised, what would happen if working class Black voters and working class white voters somehow were appealed to together, and rather than always being pitted against one another? But repeatedly, that's what we see going back to the earliest days of the Republic, up to Stan Greenberg talking to voters in Michigan, up to what we're seeing now. And you wonder if it can actually happen.
Well, it did happen, not as fully as it should have happened, but it did happen to a degree between the mid-30s and the mid to late 60s, I think. And that's the period that historians call the period of the New Deal order. The New Deal coalition was dominant in American politics, not just nationally, but in most states as well. And it happened for two reasons. First of all, because the New Deal programs did offer something to both races, much more than white people, and Black people were in effect excluded from Social Security, at least at first, not explicitly, but because agricultural and domestic workers were excluded from Social Security. But they got relief. They got government jobs to some degree on the Public Works Administration, the Civilian Conservation Corps. Their homes were lit up too by the Tennessee Valley Authority if they lived in those parts of the South that the TVA reached. And also something very important that people often don't think about, organized labor. Organized labor, especially the industrial unions of the CIO, the United Auto Workers, the electrical workers, dock workers, and several others, were interracial unions. For the first time really in American history, the labor movement was interracial. And the CIO, with help from a lot of left-wing organizers, actually, Black and white, some socialists, some communists, said, we're not going to have separate unions anymore. We're not going to say Black people, you know, we're not going to say Black people don't join our unions and Black people will be used as strike breakers against white workers. It was happened a lot before them. And so the CIO pushing interracial unionism, arguing that racism was a, quote, tool of the business class, whether or not they were right, that was the rhetoric they used, really pushed Democrats in lots of industrial states like Pennsylvania, like Michigan, like Ohio, like Michigan, which had been Republican states before this for decades, to work with to put together interracial coalitions on the state level to make sure that good jobs in state government and federal government went to Black people as well as white people. And it's that coalition that eventually pushed through the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Act, leaving, of course, white Democrats on the side and eventually leaving the party altogether. So, you know, part of my argument in the book is that you need institutions of ordinary people, working class people across racial lines to push the Democratic Party to both embrace economic justice and also racial justice. The two should not be opposed to one another. When they're opposed to one another, usually Democrats lose.
You know, there are people that you raise in the book that are there in history, but often people may not actually think about them a lot or realize who they are in context. And the first person who stood out to me was Martin Van Buren. Until I read your book, I can't tell you that I would have been talking a lot about Martin Van Buren. But in reading the book, and you really do point out the ways in which he is a seminal person. The parties that Democrats have, we'll talk about Jefferson Jackson, but really he belongs in there as a key person in the party.
Oh, yeah. I mean, one of the things I wanted to do in this book is not focus on presidents. You know, so many histories of American politics focus on presidents. Presidents matter, of course. They're, you know, they're very important men and someday, hopefully, women. But they don't build the party usually. Usually they are the beneficiaries of people who build the party. Martin Van Buren was president for one term, not a very successful one. But his real importance in the history of the Democratic Party is as the man who, more than any other individual, really put together the beginnings of this mass party with a party press, with party organizations in every major state, with an ideology that competitive parties are a good thing, not a bad thing, which, you know, the founding fathers did not like the idea of competitive parties. Martin Van Buren thought that they were better for democracy to have people actually have arguments about policies and then for the better argument to win. Well, that's, of course, somewhat romantic, but nevertheless, he wanted to make sure that the best argument would win and the best organization. And so really, he was an organization man at a time when that was something quite new. And also, he was a guy from a humble background. His father was a tavern owner in Old Kinderhook, New York, in upstate New York. And in fact, his first language was Dutch. So Van Buren's the only president whose first language was not English. And also, the term OK, which of course is not just used in English, used in almost every language, was popularized by Democrats as a nickname for Van Buren, because he came from Old Kinderhook, New York, and they like to say, OK, with Van Buren. So he was Old Kinderhook, like Andrew Jackson was Old Hickory. So, and it caught on because this is a time when American politics was like a spectator sport. And it wasn't used in the same way we use it today, but that's really where its popularity comes from.
As you go through the book, you point out the various ways in which the party consolidated and built power and figured out how to move the levers a little bit. It's one thing out west, it's one thing down south. In the Northeast, you point out Tammany Hall and what it meant for Irish Americans, and then what it meant in a broader sense for immigrant Americans. And it took me back to being a young political reporter in New York at Time Magazine, where just all you ever got with Tammany was this idea that it was synonymous with corruption, and that's all that you needed to know. But the book raises the point that it played a key role in the building of the party in teaching people how to congregate, assimilate, and bring people together and push for certain things, and that it was actually very important in the building of the party.
And also, by the 20th century, Tammany groomed some pretty, you know, progressive figures. Robert Wagner, the senator who wrote the Wagner Act, the National Labor Relations Act, which is still the governing labor law, which enables workers, if they want a union, to have the federal government run an election to give them that chance to have the union. He was also, he pushed an anti-lynching law, did not get that through. He wanted open housing. He wanted national health insurance. He basically had Bernie Sanders politics. And he came from Tammany Hall. He was a German immigrant. You know, Tammany is an interesting organization. I'm glad you brought it up. Because on the one hand, yeah, it was corrupt. The bosses of Tammany Hall made a lot of money. one of them had a 9-hole golf course and 5 houses. And clearly, they thought they were doing well by doing good. But at the same time, they did represent working people, mostly white, unfortunately, until the mid-20th century, working people in New York City. And to do that successfully, they couldn't just steal votes. They had to give people something. And what they gave people were services, not just the fabled, you know, turkey at Thanksgiving kind of thing, or turkey at Christmas, but they helped people deal with the cops. You know, they helped people find jobs. They helped if people's garbage wasn't being picked up, they found out why the garbage wasn't being picked up and so forth. So, you know, the boss of Tammany Hall, the precinct bosses, worked sometimes 14, 16 hours a day. I have a couple paragraphs in the book about a boss named Boss George Washington Plunkett, great name. Parents were Irish immigrants. And he really got up at 8 a.m. and he didn't go to bed till 1 a.m., you know, most days. He was doing services. Now, look, he was a rich guy, too. He speculated on property when he knew that a subway line was going to go through, and he got there in advance and he knew the price would go up. So you have to talk about the corruption and the reform and the service to voters at the same time. You can't just talk about the corruption, or you can't romanticize it either and talk about, well, it was a great working class institution, because obviously the guys who ran it became quite rich.
You know, one of the things that was interesting as you lay out the history of the book is there's so many things that we take for granted that you realize are an argument over time. You know, when you talk about Andrew Jackson and his stance against paper money, but that you pin it back to him, some of the things, an attitude towards banking, income tax, the Federal Reserve, the NLRB, William Jennings Bryan, you point out that he is the gestation for a lot of things in our society, organized labor, more progressive politics, public utilities, a different sort of attitude and welfare towards children. First of all, it's hard to imagine a world where these things didn't exist, and we don't realize it has been a back and forth in history the whole way through. And the book raises that. And I wanted to bring that up in the context of some of the things we debate right now, the new Green Deal, different economic policies, a universal income tax, different progressive politics. People will say, oh my God, that will never happen. But in the book, you remind us over and over and over again, a lot of progressive policies and politics, people were told that would never happen. And now they're considered to be, nobody thinks about them. It's just almost like a given. We forget that they didn't exist at one point.
I mean, Al Smith in 1928, when he ran for president, first Catholic to run major party campaign for president, and lost very badly. He was accused of being a socialist by Herbert Hoover. You know why? Because he supported a minimum wage. Any minimum wage, not a higher minimum wage, any minimum wage, which wasn't actually passed till 10 years later, 1938. Well, you know, change in America really comes from a combination of two things. One, people being pissed off and forming movements and well-organized movements to try to change their lives. And those people and those movements putting pressure on politicians to make those changes. And that's true on the right as well as the left. And that's true with the Tea Party, obviously, helped to scale back President Obama's ambitions in 2009. And he barely got the ACA through in 2010. And the Democrats lost 63 seats in that midterm election. And my subject, of course, the Democrats, without the labor movement, you don't get a lot of the changes in the New Deal and afterwards. Without the Civil Rights Movement, Black Freedom Movement is a better way to put it, you don't get the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act and the Open Housing Act. Or for that matter, more and more Black politicians running for and being elected to office. So, but at the same time, a party has to be willing to accept some of the ideas and has to see that accepting those ideas will help it win. I mean, that's in the end, of course. Politicians are not going to go out on a limb, most of them, and take stands that will not help them win elections. And that's one thing that sometimes my fellow progressives don't understand, that you can take moral stands and should take moral stands, but in the end, if taking a moral stand helps the people you don't like win the election, then sometimes you have to find ways to, let us say, you know, get there in a more indirectly, you know, because you can't always say what you want in politics and win, unfortunately.
In the book, you lay out the history of a number of Democratic candidates who the phrase almost pull their punches comes to mind, that they had everything they needed to win, and yet it goes dismally. I'm thinking of Adlai Stevenson, who's dancing 4 years before he just gets trounced because he ended up just really being a poor candidate. George McGovern sitting on a lot of things that might have helped him win over the public. And also you talk about someone like LBJ, who was a great politician, but making the decision rather than talking about economics and the needs of people, saying, you know, we're in a pretty good place, let's just keep it going. And it made me think about Hillary and her decision not to really talk about 2008 and the things that had happened since then, but to say, look at what this administration has done. We're just going to keep building. And it seems as though over and over again, you point out that when Democrats do that, hey, we're in a pretty good spot, let's just keep going, they usually are missing something.
No, it's a good point. One of the things I've criticized Democrats in op-eds for this, and former DNC chairman Tom Perez, I a couple of times in debates with him, I've said this too. People want parties to stand for something. They want politicians to stand for something. They want to know, if you're Democrat, what does that mean? If you're Republican, what does that mean? And Democrats do best when they defend a vision of moral capitalism, as I said, but specifically they do best when people know what they want. You know, for a long time, people knew what Republicans wanted. They wanted strong defense, traditional values, and besides the military, a small government, a limited government anyway. And until recently, you know, and even now, it was harder since the 60s, I think, for people to say, what do Democrats really stand for? Are they just not Republicans? Or do they stand for a program that will, you know, at least in theory, help the majority of people? And they have to be specific about what that means. FDR was specific. At times, John Kennedy was specific. And at times, Lyndon Johnson was specific, too. But since then, you know, you think of the presidential candidates come to mind, people who are old enough to remember, you know, Walter Mondale, Michael Dukakis, even Bill Clinton, who won a lot because, you know, the George H.W. Bush sort of self-destructed in many ways. Barack Obama had people give pretty good sense. At least he gave people a theme, you know, that he wanted to pursue. But I think it's better when Democrats are a little more specific. I think not every bill, but a vision about, you know, economic plan primarily that will help the majority of people. And when they don't do that, and Hillary didn't do that, and Biden didn't do that either. I mean, Biden won in large part because he wasn't Donald Trump. Let's face it, you know. Just like Bill Clinton won in large part because he wasn't George H.W. Bush. I'm not comparing Bush and Putin, Bush and Trump. That's quite a slip there.
We know what we're all thinking about these days.
Sorry about that. I think that's important. And, you know, I asked Tom Perez once when he was head of the DNC, we had this little round table we were both talking at. I said, what do Democrats stand for? And Tom Perez said, we have great values. I said, that sounds like, you know, our party will cost you less than the other party. That's what that got value, you know. You got to stand for something and obviously stand for something people like. If you're just not the other party, then we end up pretty much where we are now with two parties, neither one of which is really all that popular among a lot of Americans. More people say they're independents now than ever before since polls have been run on that question.
Interesting. You know, I wondered about your thoughts on, is there an inherent problem sometimes in the Democratic message that people might hear it as, well, I have a program for that. The GOP, on the other hand, I'm thinking of Trump, who for all the things he said in the second election, picked up Black voters, picked up Hispanic voters. You'd have thought those numbers went down. And when they ask people why, they just like this idea of he's a winner and I could be a winner too. And I thought, you know, the GOP is big on that. If you come here with a dream and you will work hard, it's possible. We will create the conditions to make it possible. Is that a more winning message than we will come up with programs that lift everybody across all tides?
Yeah, look, I'm not a strategist, so I wouldn't want to be able to put together a strategy for the Democratic Party. But I do think that, you know, for example, a lot of the programs in Build Back Better, people like in the polls. But is there anything that ties them together that Joe Biden has said, that Nancy Pelosi has said, that Democratic ads have said, that I've seen that's been convincing? I haven't seen that yet. Maybe they'll come up with something by September, but I haven't seen that yet. I wouldn't be, you know, so brave as to say what they should exactly say. Again, I'm not a strategist, but look, Trump also got more voters because people like, unfortunately or fortunately, they like the idea of a strong president, you know, and they like the idea of someone who's sort of entertaining, you know. He's a great performer. Joe Biden, you know, as Joe Biden says, God bless him, but Joe Biden is not a great performer, let's face it. You know, he's a decent guy, but he's not a great performer. Barack Obama was a great performer, you know, and that's one of the reasons I think why, despite the fact that Democrats were losing a lot of seats, he was still able to win re-election pretty easily. Because people like, you know, look, we're obviously, this has not been always true, but ever since we've had radio, which began really in a serious way with FDR. The president has been a figure who has to be a performer in the media. And presidents who are not good performers in the media usually don't do very well. Sometimes they do. LBJ was not a great performer, but he had a huge majority that he came in with. And then he ran against candidate Barry Goldwater, who was very unpopular. So, but I think in the end, you know, Democrats, the only thing they have really going for them, and it's a very big thing, is that they're a diverse party. They're a diverse coalition. And they do have a tradition, I think, at least the last few decades, at least on paper, rhetorically, of being in favor of what Bill Clinton said, you know, people who work hard and play by the rules. And so those people need to be rewarded. You know, Sherrod Brown, one of my favorite Democrats, he's a Democrat from Ohio, senator from Ohio, who's nice enough to blurb the book. He talks about the dignity of labor, the fact that, you know, most people in this society, you know, work for a living, obviously. They don't make a whole lot of money, but they make enough to live on, most people. But their jobs, you know, are ones that often, you know, they're not treated very well by the boss. They don't have the kind of decent working conditions that they should have. They don't have unions usually either to protect their rights on the job and give them a say on the job as well. And, you know, talking like that, I think, is a way to win back Democrats, more of the working class voters that used to be core Democrats from the New Deal years up until really the early 2000s.
You know, you at the end of the book, you talk a bit about Obama and you somewhat glide over 2016 and we get into Biden. It's a 320-page book. At some point you got to go, I can't put everyone in. But I wondered why you didn't choose to spend more time on 2016 and more time on Hillary, the first female candidate for either party, and sort of dive into some of the cross currents there.
No, it's a good question. As you said, I can't talk about everybody and every election. And I wanted to stick to the main themes. And I think, you know, unfortunately, Hillary was sort of more of the same, and not in terms of gender, but in terms of her politics. I think, as you mentioned, that she said she wanted to continue progress made under Obama. So in that sense, she was not a transitional figure, you know, and most of the people I spend more time on are more transitional figures. I spent a lot of time on Nancy Pelosi, for example, because she's a great party builder. And I don't think gets enough respect from Democrats or anybody else, because, again, the fact that Democrats were able to take back the majority in 2006, the fact that they took it back again in 2018, if they're able to take it back, if they're able to keep it this year, which I think would be very unlikely, but if they are, have a lot to do with the leadership, keeping that caucus together, a very diverse caucus. So to me, she's one of the, I won't say heroine, but that would show my politics. But I think she's someone who really should get more respect, like Martin Van Buren. She's in some ways the Martin Van Buren of the 21st century. Let's put it that way.
You raise a lot of different characters in the book, but I think nobody comes across as much of a behemoth in terms of shaping the party and striking the country in a different way as FDR. And I wonder, did you think it was because of the times he was in or the man that he was, that he would have been this way no matter when he ran?
You know, it's one of those counterfactual questions historians love to talk about. No way to know for sure. Look, the Democrats got lucky, you know. I hate to say the Great Depression gave them luck, but obviously Republicans were the majority party from the late 1890s up until the Great Depression. And then anybody who ran as a Democrat in 1932 would have won that election against Herbert Hoover. But he was somebody who, even though he was from a rich family, old Dutch money from the 17th century, he did know how to show empathy for people who were hurting. And of course, he was a wonderful speaker. And as I mentioned before, the fact that he went on the radio with his fireside chats, people felt like the president was coming to their homes in a way that now we take for granted. The president comes into your home with your television or your phone or whatever. Presidents, you can't get away from the president now. They're everywhere, on every screen. But back then, that was a new thing, I think. But it wasn't just that. It was also the programs. I mean, he was putting people to work, and he was siding with these popular movements. I mean, Social Security, for example, which now we take for granted. Who wouldn't want Social Security? That only happened because there were groups of old folks who were part of movements of various names, the Townsend Plan, the Ham and Eggs Plan, in different states and nationally, who demanded some sort of pension from the government, which, of course, nobody but Union War veterans had ever had before. So, you know, it had to be the programs and the man, and of course, as I mentioned before, the movements pushing him to do things that he didn't ordinarily want to do, like side with these growing labor unions. 1932 platform said nothing about labor unions at all. 1936 Democratic platform is all about labor unions, and they helped them get reelected.
We're starting to get some questions in. And the first one I love, could you speak about the recent rehabilitation of Andrew Jackson's legacy? Why is it happening?
Well, it's not happening on the Democratic side. It's happening on the Republican side. And I think it's happening. Well, first of all, Steve Bannon loves Andrew Jackson. And of course, Steve Bannon was for a while, maybe still, a very close advisor of Donald Trump's. And Jackson, you know, is a small P populist, not a capital P populist. That was the People's Party of the 1890s. But he's a figure who, first of all, came from humble background, the first president who did not come from landed wealth, either in New England or in the South. And he was a fighter. He was a battler. You know, he had fought a lot of wars against Native Americans, very brutal wars, some argue genocidal wars. But he had fought the Battle of New Orleans at the end of the War of 1812. So he had an image as a fighter, you know, as a tough guy, willing to take on his enemies and no holds barred. That's part of it. And also he was a candidate who did put together a majority party of the White South and the urban North. Tammany Hall was part of Jackson's early Tammany Hall, 1830s, was part of Jackson's organization, part of the organization which Martin Van Buren put together. So I think it's that combination of the sort of tough, you know, white fighter, you know, against evil. And he also fought the financial elite of the Second Bank of the United States, which is a very powerful institution back in the 1820s and 1830s. He refused to, he vetoed a bill passed by Congress to recharter that bank. The bank was actually headquartered in Philadelphia on Chestnut Street. And it was by far the most powerful bank in America. It was chartered by the government. And he put, and so there's also this sort of Republicans, at least Trump Republicans, want to be seen as opposing, you know, Wall Street, financial elite, global capitalism, George Soros, you know, that kind of thing. So I think that's part of it. And also, look, because Democrats no longer celebrate Andrew Jackson, because he fought wars against Native Americans to take over their lands, because he was a great defender of slavery and a slaver himself, because he wanted to expand slavery and support the annexation of Texas, which brought on the Mexican War. And so, you know, if one party can take over a hero from another party, which the other party has given up on, that's always a plus, I think, politically.
The next question, this is a grab bag. You can do with it what you will. Meaningful gerrymandering reform and campaign finance reform, abolishing the filibuster, adding extra seats to the Supreme Court, are any of these likely to happen in the near future? I'm guessing, given what Joe Biden has said, not adding extra seats to the Supreme Court, but meaningful gerrymandering and campaign finance reform or abolishing the filibuster? Your thoughts?
Not as long as Democrats have a one-seat majority in the Senate, which that seat is Kamala Harris's vote, obviously, 50-50. Majority, and I think a 5-seat or 6-seat majority in the House. You know, you can't, these would be transformative bills, transformative changes in American politics, in American government. And you don't really have transformative changes in American government with such narrow majorities. There's no example of either party being able to do that with such narrow majorities. So that's the problem. You know, it's a numbers game at a certain point. And if Democrats had the kind of majorities that LBJ had in 1965, kind of majorities that Franklin Roosevelt had in 1935, 36 to 37, they could do pretty much anything they want, but they don't have those kind of majorities. So either they have to win those majorities or some Republicans will have to be convinced to support those changes. And so far, we're not seeing that.
No. And, you know, as you looked over the span of history and these various figures coming through, is there anybody you see on the current stage that you think could have the big shoulders, the personality, the abilities to maybe be the next person?
I'm sorry, I missed you just for a second. I cut out for just for a second.
No. I was saying, you know, as you looked over the sweep of history, you know, there's certain figures who stand out as larger than life. You may not like Andrew Jackson, but in the book, he comes across as larger than life, as do some other people. Is there anybody that you look at in modern times in terms of the Democratic Party and think that person in the future could be the next person who would figure in the next Michael Kazin book as having been a big Democratic figure?
Interesting question. You know, I should say my friend Jamie Raskin is a pretty impressive guy. I said even if he wasn't my friend. Yeah, I don't know if people know him. He was
one of the House managers.
House manager impeachment. He's a very articulate guy. He's a law professor. He knows everything about constitutional law. He's a riveting speaker. But he's 60 years old, so you know he's unlikely to be, you know, the wave of the future, so to speak. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is a very, you know, charismatic figure in many ways. But of course, she's a self-proclaimed socialist, and I think we're probably pretty long from the point where Americans will elect a socialist as probably governor of New York, much less or senator of New York, much less president. But I can't think of anybody, you know, I mentioned Sherrod Brown before. I like him a lot, but he's also in his 60s. So, you know, there are probably young people out there. I don't know, you know, who are right now running for state legislature, who 10 years from now we will hear about. But right now, I don't know. I mean, who knows what will happen if Joe Biden doesn't run again, which I think is, I'd bet 50-50 he doesn't run again, depending on, of course,
interesting,
how his polls look. Then it's going to be a free-for-all, as there was last time, you know, in many ways. And we don't know who's going to come to the forefront. You know, I think we should think less. I just mentioned before about you got to be a good performer, and you do. But I think, you know, someone who could sort of talk sensibly and rationally and with a little flair as well to people would be an excellent candidate for president, or for that matter, for Senate in Pennsylvania this year, or governor. I don't know the candidates running in Pennsylvania very well at all. But if there's candidates like that, you know, I trust people more than that. I mean, the great thing about Trump is he was very entertaining. The terrible thing about Trump is that really all he had, I would say, editorializing. You know, I saw recently, I think it was one of his former national security advisors, Kelly, right, John Kelly, who said that Trump asked him once, he said, "Is Finland part of Russia?" So I thought, we don't really want a president who doesn't know that Finland's not part of Russia. That should be a job qualification for anybody to know a little bit about geography, you know, at least to know that you know, they had a war between the two of them, you know, which the Finns won back in 1939, 1940. They don't have to know that, but they should at least know Finland is not Russia. So
somebody asked, and this actually gets to something you touched on in the book, so many prominent Democrats are extremely wealthy and seem to have little connection to their constituencies. I'm looking at you, Joe Manchin. How does the party get back on track and elect candidates who legitimately seem to support labor, working people, et cetera? Is it even possible given money's influence on elections? I want to break that down into two parts. In the book, you know, you talk about the meritocracy sort of above the fray around JFK. We're not getting our hands dirty. Some people felt that way about the Obama government, that it was sort of bloodless almost, that they were not connected to the working men and women in the streets. That this, I would say a lot of people look at Democrats and they see a party that is a lot of technocrats, you know, guys in tight suits and skinny ties on computers who wouldn't know their way around a factory floor. And is that a big concern for the Democrats, that if a key message for them is being able to reach workers and unions and that sort of thing, that some of their image has become as this party of the coast?
No, I think it's true. I think it's true. And that began in many ways, actually, when they were doing well in the 30s and 40s, when they won over liberal intellectuals and you know, left-wing intellectuals often as well. And look, I teach at a liberal college, Georgetown, and I think there are two Republican professors I know in the whole, in either social science or humanities departments. And, you know, I'm very well paid as a college professor, so that's part of the problem as well. You know, the only way both parties are now, you know, hire a lot of consultants, obviously. They have big Washington establishments, both of them, all these campaign committees and finance committees, and you have to raise a lot of money. The question before asked, you know, how do we get big money out of politics? In the short one, we don't, you know, unfortunately. So the only way to do it, I think, is as I mentioned before, to have candidates like, I would say, like Sherrod Brown, maybe like AOC, who are able to talk, you know, to, you know, ordinary people in a language they can understand. And also, again, you know, I hate to keep repeating it like a mantra, but unless you have movements of working people that are pushing people to do that, then that's not going to happen. I mean, unions, private sector unionism is down to 6% of the labor force right now. And the only powerful unions in this country, with some exceptions, are police unions and teachers unions. And that means that you haven't got You know, most people organize who really need unions, really low paid workers, who really need unions don't have them. You know, where Joe Manchin's from, West Virginia, used to have some of the strongest unions in America, the United Mine Workers. And it was a Democratic state. And nobody thought that Democrats in West Virginia were elitists because they were very close to the union. And Joe Manchin is today, too. I mean, say what you will about Joe Manchin. Yeah, he's got a lot of money. He's got a yacht and everything else. But, you know, people like him in West Virginia or else he wouldn't get elected. You know, I don't like his politics, but his politics are faithful to the politics of West Virginia right now. But they would not have been faithful to the politics of West Virginia 40 years ago because he would have been far too conservative 40 years ago for West Virginia.
Yeah, and when you think about politics as a whole, if you were to pull the list and look at the number of senators and Congress people who are wealthy, it's kind of shocking. It's like a little guy has no place coming in here. You got to be a millionaire at least. Yeah. What does that do to this whole idea of politics? Like on one hand, you say, how can you connect? But then as I'm thinking through your book, half these figures we're talking about came from great deals of money. And yeah, were able to look at
FDR, you know, FDR was a president who I quote in the book, one steelworker, I think, said Roosevelt was the first president who knew his boss was a son of a bitch. Sorry, I'm using a five-letter word I shouldn't use. But and FDR was one of the richest presidents in American history. So you know, it's not that you come from money necessarily. You know, I think it's whether you seem like you have the interests and understand, you know, what people are going through in a way that, you know, Barack Obama did, I think, in the 2008 campaign. He showed a lot of empathy. Of course, he's not a rich guy. He is now, but he wasn't then. But then I think he kind of lost it some. He got into the coils of the bureaucracy, and he thought that all he had to do was talk about the policy, and that would be enough. I used to say at the time, if Barack Obama had done an equivalent of what FDR did, fireside chats, going around the country, talk to people who had lost their houses because of the financial crisis, who were out of work, you know, I think Democrats would have had a chance to hold the House in 2010, for example. Now, that's not the only thing, you know. If he showed the kind of empathy during his presidency that he showed during his campaign, I think Democrats would have done better. And I think that, in the end, is more important than personal wealth or lack of it, I think. Because, you know, a lot of people who make money think that, you know, that it gives them a chance to know more about the world than people who don't make a lot of money. And of course, they often want to be famous. So we're not going to get those people out of politics anytime soon.
No, I don't think that you will. Somebody's asking a question that's on the headlines, not necessarily the book. What can Democrats and Republicans, for that matter, do to support Ukraine in the short term and resist Putin and his vast bag of dirty tricks? I think they're just asking you this as a person. That's not necessarily in the book.
Ukraine is not in the book. folks don't realize, I mean, not the people on this call, but folks don't realize sometimes that, you know, you finish a book about a year before it comes out.
So yes.
I was more optimistic about what the Democrats could accomplish under Joe Biden's presidency when I finished the book as well. Well, again, I'm not a Ukraine expert, though, you know, I took Russian in high school. Does that help? And I teach courses about socialism, world socialism, not American socialism. But, you know, I think Democrats and in general, Americans are doing pretty much all they can do. You know, we can't send troops in there because that will risk a third world war. And we have to hope, unfortunately, that the Ukrainians will keep up the fight, because in the end, it's their country and they have to fight for it. And no troops are going to come in, you know, to help them. And if other troops came in to help them, in the end, look, they might help them win the war, but obviously the U.S. doesn't have a great track record in the last few decades of sending in troops to help people free themselves from oppressive rule, whether it's Afghanistan or Iraq or before that, Vietnam. And, you know, I think if we could send in troops, I'm not even sure that would be a good idea. But I think to try to, you know, cut off the Russian economy and continue to make Putin out to be a pariah in the world, that's pretty much what we can do. And unfortunately, fortunately or unfortunately, probably all that most Americans will stand for, because, you know, people don't want to go on summer vacation with oil prices up to $6 a gallon either. So
You said you were finishing the book as Joe Biden began his term. We're about a year in. And of course, you hear complaints from Republicans, but you also hear complaints from Democrats that it has not been the year that they anticipated. In the course of thinking back over the book and working on it and where you were when you finished it, do you have any assessment of how he's doing, how midterms look, of where we're headed, or you think it's too early to tell? I mean, are you personally disappointed?
Sure. Well, I'm disappointed, but at the same time, as I mentioned before, it was naive for Democrats or for my Republicans. It was naive for Democrats to expect and also for Republicans to fear that that Biden would get everything on his agenda accomplished. Because all you need, as we know, is one senator, Joe Manchin, or two, Kristen Sinema, to oppose it, and you don't get some of the bills passed. They have gotten some things passed. They got the infrastructure bill through, somewhat bipartisan. They got the relief bill through, of course. They've gotten a lot of judges through. I'm disappointed, but at the same time, it was naive to expect a lot to get done, given these narrow majorities, given how you depend on someone like Joe Manchin, who only the only Democrat who would have a chance to be elected statewide in West Virginia at the moment. And also mistakes will be made. You know, the Afghan pullout was obviously a mistake, and inflation, economists say, was inevitable given what happened with the pandemic and supply chain. And, you know, so I think, and Biden is not a very charismatic figure, and that hurts to a certain degree as well. So in retrospect, you know, I'm not sure how much more he could have gotten done. He could have made decisions, but that's inside baseball stuff. As far as what will happen in the midterms, a little historical trivia, not so trivial piece of trivia. Only twice since the Civil War, in the last, 170 years almost, has a party which just took over the presidency from the other party won a midterm election. Only twice. 1934, during the Great Depression, when unemployment was going down and people trusted the Democrats and FDR to help to solve the economic crisis. And 2002, when George W. Bush was still shining, if you will, in the glow of him being, you know, the president who led the country through the crisis of 9/11, after 9/11, and before the war in Iraq had begun. Only two times. And so to expect that to happen now, I think is unlikely. I think the Democrats are very likely to lose the House. And right now, probably the Senate, though Senate seats are more difficult because it's statewide. It's not just national mood, but national mood matters a lot too. And so we'll have to see. Now, what Democrats are hoping is that they'll keep those losses down and they'll be able to come back and retake the House and take the Senate in 2024. But one of the things that's happened, of course, in the last 10 to 20 years is that the parties have become so polarized and partisans are so unlikely to vote for the other party at any time for any office. It's just a matter of who turns out and in what numbers. And in 2020, of course, everyone turned out, so to speak. 66% of eligible voters turned out, the highest since William Jennings Bryan's second loss to William McKinley in 1900. And if that happens again, the losses by Democrats will probably be smaller than they fear, maybe 20 seats, maybe 15 seats in the House. Mm-hmm. But again, history doesn't show Democrats doing very well. Even if Joe Biden's popularity was 60%, maybe, but it's not going to be 60%. He'll be lucky if he gets to 50%.
At the start of every chapter in the book, you have a few quotes from various people. And one that really jumped out at me, probably the most, was one going into chapter 9. If Democrats are now seen serving the interests of the highly educated rather than the disadvantaged, it is above all because they never came up with a appropriate response to the conservative revolution of the 1980s. I wanted, you know, this was Thomas Piketty, the economist, in 2020. And, you know, that revolution goes on when we see the culture wars, when we see the economic policy. Things are a little topsy-turvy with them in terms of the foreign policy. But I wanted you to speak to that a little bit in terms of the Democrats as we close out, because there was just something about that that made the hair on my arm stand up.
Yeah, well, I mean, I said a little bit, you know, in previous questions that you asked, but Democrats were freaked out by Ronald Reagan. That's the best way to put it. Just like Republicans have been freaked out by Franklin Roosevelt, actually, in the 30s. They thought, this guy's going to dominate American politics forever. We have to start talking more this way. We have to start talking like big government's a bad thing. We have to end welfare as we know it. We have to not be so pro-union, you know, and Jesse Jackson spoke out against that, but Jesse Jackson did not win the nomination, obviously. So the left in the party was very weak and unions were still declining at the same time. So Democrats got afraid, I think, of supporting what I call moral capitalist programs and a moral capitalist vision. They got afraid of saying we have to tax rich people a lot more because they they can afford it. They can afford to support government programs. They got afraid of supporting national health insurance. They got afraid of supporting higher minimum wage, on and on and on. And that's what Piketty is talking about, I think, in that quote. And he's a French social democrat. He's a French progressive. So, and he's part of that tradition of the democratic left. And I think Democrats have been sort of groping towards that, beginning with the Great Recession, beginning with some of the things that Obama talked about. I think the fact that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren ran, pretty competitive campaigns, especially Bernie Sanders in 2020 and, of course, in 2016 for Sanders as well, taking stands that far to the left of what any Democrat has talked about since the 1960s, even since the 1930s in many ways. That's a sign, I think, and I'm hopeful that's a sign whether or not you supported, Sanders or Warren or even Biden. That's a sign, I think, that Democrats were and still are groping towards a more clear agenda that will support the needs of and support the desires, really, of majority of Americans who really want government to take care of them and for rich people to pay their fair share and for, Democrats not to be a party that talks down to them or only supports, issues that divide people, at least how they see it. But, that's really the task for Democrats. It's been a long time since they talked like that in a consistent, clear, and dramatic way. And they need to do that again.
Well, Michael Kazin, thank you so much for being with us tonight. The book, what do you want to hold it up again? You asked me if you could hold up the book. Lots of thoughts and laying out the history of the Democratic Party. Thank you so much for being with us tonight to talk about it.
And thanks for your great questions, Tam. And thanks for all the people in the audience for showing up. I wish I could see your faces.
All right. Have a good night.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/author events.